Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. And today we're going to be talking about some subject matter you may or may not have had experience with, and it relates to the area of business, but we're also going to be discussing how we need to look at the laws that are in place regarding a number of different things and how it affects innovation for the 21st century. Now, my guest, Michael Carrier, is a professor of law. Michael, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're a professor of law at Rutgers University School of Law in Camden. You have been very much involved on the subject matters of antitrust and intellectual property laws, and you're considered to be one of the leading authorities on what is stated as the intersection of these laws. And I, Michael, was very intrigued with your information because in today's world with technology, people that are inventive, that are able to get patents, copyrights, you know, there's all kinds of levels that are involved with this, and I know of someone who, to get a patent on what he has submitted, I have learned that when someone submits a patent, well, you're usually going to be rejected the first time around. You have to resubmit it, and this stuff isn't inexpensive. It's thousands of dollars, but you have to plan on at least 2 years, if you're lucky, to get it approved. And I thought, this material that you have put together in this book, Innovation for the 21st Century, you're about upgrading and being more present with the world today. Why has this become such a passion for you, Michael?
It's become a passion because I teach and write in the areas of intellectual property, like patents and copyrights, like you talked about. I think it's important that we come up with new ideas, we come up with new innovations, and I also have an interest in antitrust law. I want the market to work the right way, and I want it to be fair for competitors. And when you put those two things together, you get all sorts of interesting issues, and that basically has kept me busy my time in legal academia.
Well, I can understand this. And one of the things that you state right in the very beginning of your book is that the laws that we have in place are truly stifling innovation. We all know how the United States has fallen far behind in the areas of innovation, and there's aspects of education and so on and so forth. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the laws. And a lot of the laws that are in place on the books today don't apply to international environments. So you've really got a challenge here. And let's start off with understanding, or for those that are listening, maybe somebody has written some material, intellectual property is so important. How can they protect intellectual property? And let's describe what that intellectual property is. What is it? How do you protect it, whether it's through a patent and a copyright, and what's the difference?
Sure. So intellectual property refers to several types of protection. Let's focus on patents and copyrights. There's also other types like trademarks, which deals with brand names, trade secrets, things that companies want to keep secret. But primarily the two main ones that we can focus on are patents and copyrights. Patents apply to inventions. So let's say you came up with a new device that someone never came up with before. You would want to go to the patent office, and just like you mentioned earlier, it will take a couple years. It could cost you at least $10,000. But if you have a good invention that you think really can do well on the market, you really need to go get a patent. Copyrights apply to things like words on a page. So books or poems or plays or movies or songs or music files or things like that, that would apply to copyright. And so the copyright would protect those written expressions. Patent would protect more inventions.
Let me ask you a question. When someone is in the process of getting a patent, we see all kinds of products that have patent pending. Does that give them any kind of a protection? Because my understanding is once you've put your patent out, everything about what you are patenting is going to be revealed to everybody in the world. So what value is a patent? If you're putting it out there where everybody's going to figure out what to do with it, and then they're going to just maybe make a little tweak so it's just a little bit different, what's the value of doing that? I mean, in today's world, we have stuff happening so fast, and with all the litigation and all the timing on this, what can we do? Because timing really is an essence in today's world of speed and technology.
Yes, timing is of the essence. And so basically there are a couple things. The first thing you could do is just not to decide to get a patent at all because of the reason that you raised. So, for example, Coca-Cola has a trade secret in its formula for the soda. It does
Right.
not want to reveal it and get a patent on it because by doing so, it would be revealing its formula to the rest of the world, and it doesn't want to do that. So some companies keep things like that, business processes, things that are central to its business models, a secret because they don't want to disclose it. Other companies do file for patent protection, and you're right. When you apply for a patent, that patent application is made public at a certain period in time, so everyone does get to see it. On the other hand, you do get patent protection. Assuming that you do get a patent, and most patents are granted today, then you do get protection, and that period runs for 20 years from the time of the patent application. So you would be protected from the time of the application. So even if it's pending, you could go back and say, I have protection from the time that I applied for it.
Uh-huh. Now, what if somebody comes along and they may or may not have seen your patent information and they've come up with this wonderful idea? They're one of these people that just is very innovative and their mind is just always going ding, 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 ding with new concepts. And they figure out a way. They walk into a box store of some kind and they look at something and they go, wow. Well, if we just did this little thing and we did that little thing, then we can do it. And they decide to go out and manufacture it. They're going to be hauled into court. Maybe what they've done has just tweaked something a little bit different, and plagiarism may not be the correct term to use here, but they have seen what somebody's done. They've improved it, and they, if somebody finds out about it, they're out of luck because they could be shut down, couldn't they?
They could be shut down. So what patent law does is it really encourages the first inventor. It says we really want to get some invention on the market. So if you're the first one to come to the patent office, then you're entitled to an invention. So if the second party comes just a day later or a year later because it sees the first product in the store, it's going to be too late because the first one already has gone to the patent office. Now, it does get a bit complicated when there are improvements. So maybe number two offers such an improvement on the first product that it is able to get a patent itself. And so it's called an improvement patent, and so then the two parties can always enter into a licensing agreement. But the initial question is, what happens to number two? And sometimes they're just out of luck.
You really want to see more support for innovation. What is the biggest headache that you perceive at this time that people dealing with copyrights, patents, we'll stay in that specific area for the moment, are having to contend with? And what do you see as options that can be done legally? Because it's said that we, you know, when it comes to laws, everything is so plastic. It's just people wonder, gee whiz, do I really have a chance to be protected? And if so, am I going to end up being destroyed because of litigation if someone brings something against me or what have you. What do you see as the biggest problem?
As a result of writing this book, I came to realize that copyright law is the most significant hurdle to innovation. So my book talks about patent law, copyright law, and antitrust law, and thinks that these laws are designed to promote innovation. And the patent system has gotten a lot of attention. It's gotten a lot of media about the problems and about silly patents, things like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich patent, and people make jokes about that. But I actually found that the patent system has gotten better in recent years at promoting innovation. Antitrust as well has gotten better. It used to be a bit old and not really thinking about innovation, but now it has done better. What people have not realized, and the insight that I really learned from writing this book, is that copyright law is the law that has it backwards when it comes to innovation. The way the law is set up, in particular in one context, in terms of punishing parties that assist others in copyright infringement, is the one place where I think the law has it backwards.
All right. Give us an example.
So an example is what's known as the law of secondary liability. So let's say I have a copyright and someone infringes it. They make a copy of it or they send it. They're a direct infringer. They directly violated my rights. Now let's say that we don't have a direct infringer, but someone that helped them to infringe. Think the TV or the VCR or the radio, the computer, the internet, the CD burner, anything like this can help someone to infringe. So the question is, what do we do to that party? Do we say that, you know what, you're helping others to infringe, so therefore we'll send you to jail? Or do we say it's a technology, we should try to promote technological innovation, and so therefore we shouldn't punish you even if someone uses your technology to infringe copyright? And so my point here is that the law is out of whack. It punishes a lot of these parties, like search engines and peer-to-peer software and internet service providers, because their materials or their services can be used indirectly to promote infringement.
There was some information that I found really an eye-opener, because I had no idea that when someone submitted a patent application, that one of the reasons that it may be turned down, and we're, I don't know, how many patents have been submitted? I mean, it's in the millions, isn't it?
It really is, yes.
All right. So you have, I don't know how many people are on staff for the patent office, but they are given less than 20 hours to do the research. No wonder it takes so long. I mean, even with our upgraded technology, which I'm sure a lot of the stuff has been put into computer systems, which makes the research even better than it would have been 10 years ago. But when you think about that, and some of these patents that are sent in are quite innovative and very complicated, and if someone's not educated in this, how can they make a good judgment?
You're right that the resource constraints on the patent office are extreme. It is very difficult to get a patent through the patent office quickly because, as you point out, traditionally examiners at the patent office only have about 20 hours or so to go through some really complicated inventions and compare it to what's called the prior art, all the inventions that came before, and figure out if this one should get a patent. And so there really are some challenges. And to be fair, the new head of the patent office, he's been there a couple of years, David Kappos from IBM, is aware of this issue and is trying to fix the problem, but it really is an issue at the patent office because there are so many patents that come in.
Absolutely, and when you look at so much of our technology, disruptive technology, this is a term that has been coming up more and more, and things are moving at such a speed today that the attitude of many is, let's just get it out there on the market because day after tomorrow somebody's going to come along and make something even better. I was looking at a program just within the past couple of hours where these, the notebooks and other things, one, they're making them of lighter materials. Two, now you can be able to kick them across a football field and they'll survive. It's just amazing. And a lot of this technology came out a while back, but the refinements that keep being added, and then you have the international marketplace that comes in. Wow, we are in an incredible time. Let's talk about disruptive technologies. We might have somebody listening to the show today that just loves being a problem solver. How can we improve something? Well, try purple, green, yellow, and a couple of ducks, and you got it. And they might be right on the money. How do we deal with this disruptive technology today? What suggestions would you have for a person that is of that innovative style? And how can we as a nation actually get back into the world of innovation and start becoming a leader again?
So this goes back to what I said before about copyright law and how it has it backwards. So when copyright law says, let's get into the mind of the party that came up with this technology, we don't like something that they said, we're going to strike that down, the technology, because it could be used for infringement and we don't like what's in your mind, you are stifling disruptive technology. Basically, when you look at innovation, you can divide it several ways, but one way is between sustaining and disruptive innovation. Sustaining innovation is what the large companies do, and they do it very well. They come up with generations of products that are a little different than the last generation. So there, they're able to make their customers happy, they make their shareholders happy, and things get better little by little, and that's a good thing. But there's also disruptive innovation, and that's something that the biggest companies oftentimes are not prepared to engage in, because in a sense it's a threat to their business model. And so if you think of the music industry about a decade ago when they were confronted with Napster, they had a great business model based on the CD. And then Napster came in and the internet came in, and that threatened their entire business model. So there you really had a disruptive type of innovation, and sometimes what happens is the largest companies don't appreciate it, so they try to stifle it. And so that's why we should really focus on that disruptive innovation, even if it's not the best thing for the biggest companies.
Well, I find it interesting, especially when you look at the international positioning. There are so many people that have gotten very excited about China, but one thing about China is there's no such thing as being able to get a patent or a copyright. Everything belongs to the country, period. You go in fact, I've known of a number of business people who are very innovative, and they would have liked to have gone into China, but they were told distinctly, if you think that your stuff is not going to be copied and put out there, be aware, it is, and you have no rights in this country. So I look at that, and then I come back to the United States and how many times our intellectual hands are tied because of the laws that are in place. You bring out something that I thought was just amazing, and it had to do with the pharmaceutical industry. And I realize we're sort of going into the antitrust area here, but I'd like to digress for just a minute. There was this situation, and it relates to the Hatch-Waxman Act that came out by Congress in 1984, and it was about generic firms where they were going to produce pharmaceutical products, and it would challenge what we call the big pharma company. And there is a term you have in your book called reverse payments. This was a level of education for me. It didn't surprise me what happened. But it really was a negative because those generic medications are not now available or readily as easily available to the consumer as they would have been if this agreement hadn't happened. Would you please talk about this case and why you wanted to cover this in your book as well?
So when you talk about things like antitrust law and patent law, you need to think about the pharmaceutical industry. Some of the most interesting and difficult issues in these laws takes place in the industry. And the reason is that you can talk about the need for patents in different industries. You can question, do you really need it in certain industries? But in the pharmaceutical industry, I think there is a very strong argument that you do need patents because it is so expensive to create drugs. It takes so long. So you do need to have patents. On the other hand, just because you have a patent doesn't mean that everything you do as a pharmaceutical company is okay. And so what's complicated here is you have patent law, you have antitrust law, and then you have, as you mentioned, the Hatch-Waxman Act, which was passed in 1984 to try to promote innovation and also to get more generics on the market. At the time, there were not a lot of generics, and so Congress wanted to get more generics because when you have a generic drug, the price falls a lot, and of course consumers would want to spend as little as possible, and so that's why generic medications are a good thing. The problem here is that the brand name drug company that has the patent in these cases will pay the generic, and that's the reverse payment. It's a payment that goes from the brand company to the generic for the generic to drop its lawsuit and not enter the market. And so basically, even though the generic might be able and willing to enter the market and ready to enter the market, they take money and they say, I'm not going to enter the market for another 5 or 10 years, and that is the harm for consumers. Instead of paying generic prices, we're now spending higher brand prices for the next 5 or 10 years.
Well, it's just a real eye-opener, and that's why your book, Innovation for the 21st Century, is very important. Now, let's also go into the aspect of medicine, and you bring out some terms that were new terms for me. You say between patents and innovation, you have a section in your book that deals with a post-grant opposition system, a framework for determining relief in patent infringement cases. You also talk about means to expand access to patented research tools in the biotechnology industry, which is just growing by leaps and bounds. And then a new template for material transfer agreements that increases scientists' access to materials needed for research. Now, this is really, in many instances, a hot potato. And so many areas of R&D are just slam dunked. They are not able to move forward. Would you address the post-grant opposition system and go into a little bit of detail on this?
Sure. So the four things that you mentioned, the post-grant opposition, remedies, research tools, and material transfer agreements, are my four recommendations for how we can improve patent law. So in this book, I try to offer some solutions, 10 areas in law where there are problems with patent, copyright, and antitrust law, as well as offering solutions to how we could get more innovation. A post-grant opposition goes directly to the question we started off with about the patent office and only having 20 hours for each application. So you might imagine if the patent examiners don't really have enough time to consider every application, they might make some mistakes. And they might say that some patents are new when they really are not new. So a post-grant opposition is post-grant. It's after the patent is issued, and it's an opposition. It allows third parties, other parties that are not part of the transaction, to come in and to challenge the patent and say, you know what, patent office, I think you made a mistake here, and so it's a quicker way to challenge the patent rather than going to court, because going to court will take a very long time. So I'm saying we should have a post-grant opposition system because that would get rid of some of these invalid patents.
There is a very significant connection economically between innovation and economic growth. Can you give us some statistics relative to the United States especially, and maybe compare with another country as to how we have fallen back and how others have gone forward?
So the U.S. used to be the leader in so many of these metrics, like college education and math and science education and all of that, and now we really have fallen behind. So we're about 20th in the world in things like math and science education. And so this is one element that is very important. It's the workforce that we have, the education system that we have. And in the book, I focus on law, but it certainly is the case that so many other things affect how competitive the United States can be.
I agree, and I think that that is very, very significant. In fact, you quote a professor, Paul Romer, that even a small increase in innovation can have a significant cumulative effect on living standards. And he said an increase of 0.5%. That's nothing. 0.5% per year in the growth rate would result in a 28% increase in the gross domestic product by 2050. My gracious, that's a long time projection here. We need something sooner than that. How do you feel about this, Michael, when you're looking at the circumstances as they are now, when you see all of the political rhetoric that we go through, you as an individual and the students that you interact with and the other professionals that you talk with, can they see a resolution of any kind with this before 2050, for heaven's sakes? Can't we get something done before then? Is it going to take this fossil process to keep going?
I hope we can get something done by 2050. That's a long time away. And I think that the point here is that these economists are saying that innovation is the most important factor in economic growth. So there are other things you can do. For example, you can lower price. But if you want the economy to grow, innovation really is a rising tide that raises all boats. And so we really want to have innovation because that will lead to better standards of living, better products, better ways to communicate and interact with each other. And so that's basically why I wrote this book, because innovation is so crucial that if we make some changes, and they can be small changes, that might be enough to make a big difference in our GDP.
Oh, I agree. Now, Michael, I know that we're just about out of time. Is there a website that people, if they want to know more about patents, copyright, antitrust, intellectual property, I mean, you cover so much in this book. Your detail is really easy, I think, to be able to read and understand. And I just say have a highlighter in hand, folks, because you may want to do that with his book. Michael, what is it that they can use as a reference to this?
So I would just check my website. My name is Michael Carrier, C-A-R-R-I-E-R. I'm at Rutgers, R-U-T-G-E-R-S, and you just punch that into Google, Michael Carrier Rutgers, and my website will pop right up. It's my website at Rutgers, and that has a list of all of my publications, about 40 articles or so. Right up front is a link to the book. You can buy it at Amazon. The paperback version is out. The Kindle version recently came out. It's only about $15 on Kindle. And so I would send you to my website, Michael Carrier Rutgers, and there you would have access to my book as well as all of my articles.
Fabulous. Well, Michael Carrier, it's been a delight having you as a guest. I was really very impressed with your book, Innovation for the 21st Century. This book will give you some insights, some possibilities on how we can harness the power of intellectual property and antitrust law. If you are curious about these things, this is a good read. It has some thinking that's outside the box of common experience, and I think that is usually a very positive perspective to look at. We have to look at things differently because we're not dealing in the 1800s, 1800s. This is the 21st century, and the world is very different, especially when it comes to technology. Michael, thank you so very much for being my guest today. It's a pleasure. Michael Carrier, Innovation for the 21st Century. Check it out. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We'll be right back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedros accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny. They will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Tickets now on sale for the 2012 Conscious Life Expo, February 10th through the 13th at the LAX Hilton. Bringing together an eclectic community of speakers, panelists, exhibitors, artists, and visionaries for a four-day gathering of collective consciousness featuring over 150 workshops, special events, including TV British psychic Lisa Williams and visionary scientist and author Greg Braden, as well as the film festival, live music, Programa Latino, and three exhibit halls packed with healthy products and services. For ticket information, www.consciouslifeexpo.com.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30, and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children, too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. This is just a delight having you with me today, and I want you to know you can call in toll-free and chat with me at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008, and all I need from you is your first name or initial if you're a first-time listener, and then let me tell you what I perceive, and then after that, you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you desire. I think today's world, we have so much litigation going on, and it's so easy to tie things up so that by the time you get out of court, the world's moved on about 500,000 miles ahead of you. And when it comes to the world of business, life is business, and innovation is necessary. And if you pay attention to nature, you'll find that nature is always reinventing itself. And I'm always intrigued when people will have an attitude that things should always stay the same, that they should never change. Well, I agree that in some environments that may work well. But one of the reasons that we are able to enjoy a lot of the items that we have today is because someone, somewhere, decided there was a better way of doing things. Now, we can complain about that, and we can fuss about various things that have evolved that we've found over the long term that have not been so positive. But without that evolution of improvement, most of us living in the United States would still be back in horse and buggies. We never would have even gotten to the automobile phase. It takes innovation. And there's a saying that I really believe in, and that is we stand on the shoulders of the giants that have gone before us. And that's very true. So when something has been very good and it's time to bring something along and make it better, that's important. I am always really in awe of how so much has been done by individuals that we never hear anything about. And let me share a story with you. relative to our discussion of today, and this goes back a number of years, I had a very good friend. Her name was Bonnie, and she was married to Fred. And Bonnie was a housewife, but Fred was one of these problem-solving people, and he worked for Hughes Aircraft. He had been with him for years, and this is a guy that was getting bonuses right and left. His family, of course, benefited, but Hughes Aircraft at the time had this wonderful policy in place. They encouraged their employees to be innovative. Those people on the assembly lines in any area of the company, if they could come up with a process, a technique, a product that could improve the company, it would become company property, but they would get this wonderful bonus. Fred was not a person that really ever wanted to become world famous or a Thomas Edison. But in his work for the company and in working day to day, he came up with so many ideas that would improve the assembly line process, save time, create a level of efficiency, because he was dealing with different components every single day. An executive in the top office wouldn't have a clue because he's not down on that assembly line. But this is how the company at that time, many years ago, worked with their employees. And Fred would just get all excited. He was the type of guy that was always, what can be improved here? And he had a capacity of looking at things in a big picture and reducing down to that finite point of, gee, we could save 3 seconds if we did it this way. Tested it out. They find he was right. Bingo. He gets a wonderful bonus. J. Paul Getty was a man who was, my goodness, he had so much money that probably angels borrowed from him. I really think that this man had such a level of understanding regarding how you work with people. Now, he wasn't necessarily known for his, what I would say, a sparkling, joyful personality. However, this man had an attitude that we have to be able to look at how we can streamline things. And he woke up to the reality when he was developing his company that there was a lot of waste that was going on. Now, this is a guy that started out being a wildcatter. Now, he did all of his bookkeeping in the back of his Model T Ford. That's what he did. And he was out in the oil field. But he knew his numbers. And he found at one time with his business that a lot of money was just being wasted. There was tremendous waste. And one of his employees came up with something so simple as saving paper clips and using them again and again. There was a process. Of course, they didn't have computers then, and there were a lot of things that were different. So much was done by hand. And he thought about it, and he said, well, try it. See if it makes a difference. Well, the company ended up saving, I think, like $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 a year or whatever. Now, that may not sound like a lot if you're dealing with a company that's worth millions. But, you know, it's something wherever you find that you can streamline things, you don't give up your quality, but you improve the process, and you are efficient in the utilization of whatever you are using, your bottom line is going to be better. And you're going to be able to pay your people better. You're going to be able to do a lot of things better. I think our politicians could take some lessons, don't you think? My goodness, it's always amazing to me how the American people are asked to be really financially tight. Come on, let's tighten that financial belt. And then we have a bunch of ding-dongs that say, well, let's go and invest $1 billion here and $1 billion there. And gee whiz, maybe we'll talk about budgeting someday. All of us that have had to deal with saving realize that you have to look at what it is you want to do and how you want to do it. So, and how you are going to be impacted on the bottom line. And most families that I'm aware of today, they will sit down and will make assessments. Can we spend this? Can we spend that? Is there something we can do that we can have the quality of our life? But how do we do it differently? So we are in a very interesting time here. We do not want to suppress innovation. We want to be open to new ideas. And for those of you that are problem solvers and idea people, don't keep your mouth shut. Step out there. be willing to be that innovative personality and be willing to develop associations with people who will be supportive of that innovation. It does take time. It does take money. But I guarantee you there is no reason why that aspect of what makes our life rich and full and even better than ever before cannot be continued, and that we should be able to continue to do that. I'm really very supportive of it. Without imagination, without creativity, without educating our young people and encouraging them to be open and receptive to new ideas, to new experiences, well, we're going to be left behind, as has occurred. We take things for granted. But I got news for you. Innovation isn't exclusive to any country, any place, or any space. It is ever-present everywhere. So it's who is going to get their act together first. It's an interesting aspect of life. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd want to chat. 888-627-6008 if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Oh, tomorrow we're going to be talking about money with Charles Green, and this is about getting finance, and this is related to business. And if you're a small business person, but it's really good down-to-earth information. Charles Green is going to be my guest. And then we're also going to be talking with Cliff Fazzolari. Now, Cliff has authored a couple of books, and one of the books is on his brother when he died. It's called Life and Times of Jeff Fazzolari. He's won a number of awards for this book, and there's some really interesting paranormal experiences that Cliff experienced after his brother passed. So we're going to have a chance to talk with both him and Charles Green. So I'm looking forward to sharing that with you tomorrow. I hope you will be able to join me then. Before we go on break, I wanted to share a story with you. This is a true story, and it takes place in January of 1932, and there was a woman by the name of Mrs. Charles Williamson. She was of Bladenboro, North Carolina. She had on a cotton dress, and all of a sudden, the dress burst into flames. Well, her husband and daughter were nearby, and they ripped the dress off of her, and nobody got burned. Now, have that picture in your head. Dress ablaze. Mrs. Williamson did not get any burns. Her husband didn't, nor the daughter, when they handled the burning material. Now, she had not been in contact with any flammable fluids. There was nothing around her. She wasn't working at a stove or anything that would have caused this material to just explode into flames. Now, what is even more fascinating is that there was a pair of Mr. Williamson's pants. They had been hanging in his closet. They burst into flames. Then the curtains and the bed of an empty room burst into flames. Now, this is what was noted about these flames. They were bluish. They were like jet flames, just really extending out. There was no odor, and there was no smoke. These flames were shooting out of various household items, causing these items to completely incinerate, but not affecting whatever they were next to. Is that eerie or what? They couldn't put the flames out, but the flames disappeared when whatever they were burning was totally incinerated. Now, 4 days after these incidents had started, a lot of fire incidents happened in front of a number of witnesses, and the family ended up leaving the home. They didn't know what was going on. Now, they brought in arson experts, all kinds of investigators, tried to figure out what was going on, and they couldn't find it out. And the electric gas companies, they didn't know. On the fifth day, the fire stopped as mysteriously as they had started, and the family returned to the house. There was a report where a comment was made. The fire started, burned out, and vanished as mysteriously as if guided by invisible hands. there has been no logical explanation. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. Four out of the last eight Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Tickets now on sale for the 2012 Conscious Life Expo, February 10th through the 13th at the LAX Hilton. Bringing together an eclectic community of speakers, panelists, exhibitors, artists, and visionaries for a four-day gathering of collective consciousness featuring over 150 workshops, special events, including TV British psychic Lisa Williams and visionary scientist and author Greg Braden, as well as the film festival, live music, Programa Latino, and three exhibit halls packed with healthy products and services. For ticket information, www.consciouslifeexpo.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. Quick like a bunny, I want to remind those of you who are in the state of Washington, which today, after all of the storms we've had, is absolutely gorgeously beautiful. The sun actually is out. The gray that Seattle is known for, well, it has sort of dissipated. We have these beautiful blue skies with golden sunshine. It is awesome. So anyway, on Saturday, day after tomorrow, my class, Quantum Mind 2, is happening at Bridgeport Place, and I would love to see you there if you're able to come. We have a few openings left, so if you'd like to make a reservation for Quantum Mind, we're going to have Robert Newman, who's going to be presenting information on feng shui, how to apply it for the new year of 2012. And then he's going to be doing the first half of the program. I'll be doing the second half of the program. We're going to be experiencing blindfold demonstrations, and we're going to be talking about how you can empower yourself this year in developing your own psychic skills. So this is going to be a very interactive class. It is $59.95. Give me a call if you want to be a part of this, and we'll put you in as one of those reservations. The number to call is 253-582-5604. For those of you in Los Angeles, I am going to be down there at the Conscious Life Expo, and I'm going to be there the 10th, the 11th, and the 12th. And I'm going to be at the event, and I'll also be in the Los Angeles area available for private appointments for about a day, day and a half before I fly home. So if you'd like to have more information about the Conscious Life Expo, then check them out on the web, consciouslifeexpo.com. Also, you can check out my newsletter at DelphiInternational.com, and all the details will be there. This is a fabulous event. You don't want to miss it if you're in the Los Angeles area. Well, I have got a delightful recipe, and I love the title of it. It's called Bubble and Squeak Pie. Yes, Bubble and Squeak Pie. Now, this is something that's pretty economical, but it is so different. And I think for company, or if you just wanted to do something special for yourself, this is a great recipe to do. Now, this is an English-style dish. The English really apparently have some version of this, and this has just sort of been brought up to date. Now, for calories, maybe you don't want to have this on a daily basis, but I'll tell you what, every once in a while having something like this, and it's going to be beautiful in presentation, and serving it with a side of fruit or vegetables if you wanted. You could have this for a Sunday brunch. It would just be awesome. Now, this is the recipe that you need, the ingredients that you need for bubble and squeak pie. And the secret to making it easy to do is your ready-made puff pastry. So let's get down to the ingredients. You're going to need 2 tablespoons of butter, 2 tablespoons of butter, 1 onion, and you want to chop that onion sort of fine. And you're going to need 1.5 pounds of new or red potatoes. 1.5 pounds of new or red potatoes, and they need to be peeled, boiled, and cooled. And then you need 1/4 teaspoon of sea salt, 1/4 teaspoon of sea salt, 1/4 teaspoon of pepper. You need 1 egg yolk, and then 1 package of puff pastry sheets. And those packages are about 17.5 ounces. You're going to need 7 ounces of cheddar cheese. You want it shredded, and that's going to be about 1.5 cups. I'd recommend the extra sharp. It is really going to add to the flavor of this. Then you're going to need about 4 ounces of cabbage or leafy greens like your mustard greens or kale, and you want to chop them. If you roll the leaves of the greens up, and then you just cut them with a sharp knife, and then it comes to about 1.5 cups, and then you steam them, and then you let them cool. Now, this is just real, real simple. Here's what you do. Your butter, you melt it in a large skillet over medium heat. You put in your onion, and you cook it until the onion is soft and sort of translucent. That's going to take you about 3 minutes. And then, after your potatoes, of course, you have already cooked and they're cool, and you want to coarsely mash your potatoes, and then you want to add the onion and some salt and pepper. And you want to take your egg yolk that you have, you want to add 1 tablespoon of water to that egg yolk and put it to the side. Your oven should be preheated to 400 degrees and on a lightly floured work surface. You want to roll out 1 pastry sheet to about 13 inches square. You want to fit it into a 9-inch springform pan so that the edges of the pastry hang over the side of the pan. Now, your cheese that you've grated, you want to stir it into your potatoes and then take half of that and put that mixture, your cheese and potato mixture, in the bottom of your pan. Then you top it with an even layer of cabbage or whatever leafy green you want to use, and then put your remaining potato mixture on top of the green. Then you roll out your remaining pastry into a 10-inch square, and then using the bottom of the pan as a guide, cut it into a 9-inch round. Put the pastry round on top of the potato mixture. Trim the overhanging bottom pastry to within 3/4 of the pastry round top, and then brush the top with some of the yolk mixture. Fold your excess pastry over the top of the pie to seal. Brush your edge with egg yolk. Cut 4 slits into the top. Bake it 40 minutes until it's done. And what I would say is with a springform pan, then naturally when you take it out of the oven, let it sit for about 5 minutes before you remove the sides. It is just going to be absolutely beautiful. And I like cheese, so you might want to have a little bit of that extra grated cheese around and just sprinkle it on the top or serve it on the side, but I really like to have it sort of melt over the top. Really good and very different. You're not going to find any of your friends who have made this. It's absolutely awesome. This is Donna Sebo. We've run out of time. I'm so delighted you were able to join me today. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You know, who knows? You may be that person that ends up bringing an idea to the marketplace that other people will say, wow, I didn't think it was possible, and you did it. Keep those ideas flowing. That's what makes this world such an interesting place. Donna Sebo here. Talk with you tomorrow. Same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.